I certainly mirror everything he said about our time together and our enjoyment and the rich blessings that he has meant to the kingdom of heaven, and certainly we appreciate him very much for that. Brother McLeish and all the elders and those of this congregation who have invited us to be present tonight, we appreciate so much your invitation, and certainly to be a part of this 12th annual Denton Lectureship is always a great honor and a great privilege for which we extend to you our gratitude. I don't know of anything that means more to us than the privilege of being on such lectureships as this over our country and enjoying the fellowship of good friends and brethren in Christ. And indeed, some of the warmest, finest people in the world are here tonight. Brother Dubb said that they didn't ask you anymore where you're from. And that reminded me of a man in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, who wrote me a note. He couldn't speak because his voice box was gone. But he wanted to tell me about a tour he had made in Texas with he and his wife. And he said that the tour guide announced over the speaker that they used to ask where people were from. But he said, if they're from Texas, they all tell you anyway. And he said, if they're not, why embarrass them? It's wonderful tonight to be together. And certainly we appreciate those from Southwest who are here tonight in Austin. We are living there now and working with that good congregation. And we appreciate all the work that's being done there, and we want you to know about that work. We have Christian Worker papers over in the book room, and we'd like for you to take a look at those. We also have a display concerning the Southwest School of Bible Studies, one of the greatest schools in our brotherhood. And, of course, with Brother Joseph Metter at the helm now, we believe that it is going to even go further than what it has in the past. I think Brother Joseph Metter is one of the finest men that I've ever known. And he and all of the school are here tonight, and they're down front. And for that, I am grateful. They are an outstanding group of men who are going to preach the gospel all over our nation. And we anticipate the thousands that they shall be able to convert. And we appreciate them so very much. Tomorrow at noon, there will be a supporters and alumni luncheon at the Western Sizzlin' restaurant, and we invite all of you to make your plans to be there for that dinner in support of the School of Preaching at Southwest. We know that there are several schools represented, and for all of these schools, we appreciate their work, and no doubt there are several here tonight from the old Elk City School of Preaching, which I had the privilege of working with a few years ago. But it is a delight to be here. It is a delight to speak for you tonight. And I trust that with five chapters from 2 Kings, we shall be able to hit some of the high points that are found in these chapters. Indeed, Paul wrote to Timothy that all scripture inspired of God is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness, that the man of God may be complete, thoroughly furnished unto every good work. The Old Testament scriptures are that which he was applying that to, showing us that they're profitable. And any man who doesn't recognize the scriptures of God as profitable tonight is not going to have the guidance for life that he needs. Each of us in this audience need the direction that the scriptures give us. And indeed, Romans 15 and verse 4 said, these things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through steadfastness or patience and the comfort of the scriptures might have hope. Indeed, that hope should burn brightly within our hearts, and we should ever look for those things which the scriptures help us to understand. The scriptures, of course, should be upon our mind night and day. The psalmist said, blessed is the man who walketh not in the counsel of the wicked, nor standeth in the way of sinners, or sitteth in the seat of the scornful, but his delight is in the law of Jehovah, and upon his law doth he meditate day and night. Therefore, Proverbs, the wise man Solomon said in chapter 3, verse 5 and 6, trust in Jehovah with all thine heart. Lean not upon thine own understanding. In all of thy ways acknowledge him, and he will direct thy path. What do you know of in subject matter that is not revealed in the Bible? There is intrigue, there is love, there's hate. There are all kinds of strong friendships, there are murders, their disasters, their crimes, their divine benefits, and there is divine judgment. And as you read these things, you realize that indeed our lives are short, and we must put our trust in Jehovah God. We must realize, as did these men of old, that except we serve Jehovah, except Jehovah build the house, they labor in vain that built it. Psalms 127 and verse 1. And the wise man Solomon said at the close of his book, "This is the end of the matter. All hath been heard. Fear God. Keep his commandments. For this is the whole duty of man." Some of the kings of Judah and Israel feared God. Some of them reverenced God. Others of them were taken over by idolatry and steeped in the deepest of sin. But we find in these things God recorded all of them in order that we might know how he deals with sin as well as with righteousness. And God, who deals with these things, has left us this revelation, which over a 1,600-year period of time he revealed to us in order that we might understand and know his will and how he deals with us. How comforting it is to know that he never forgets the righteous, that he always remembers his promises, that he never fails to take his enemies to task, no matter whether years may pass before those promises are kept. In the first part of 2 Kings 6, we find there the account of how Elisha is approached by the young prophets of the school of the prophets. They had preacher schools then too. And this school of the prophets was under the directorship of Elisha. Elisha means God is salvation, and his name certainly he carried out well while he was upon the earth. It also shows us here he, being a disciple and a successor of Elijah, carries on the great work that Elijah did in obedience to God. Elisha, of course, is a faithful son and indeed one who could be trusted in all things. Elisha approved the undertaking of these sons of the prophets to build a new place for their work. They thought they would go down to the Jordan and there they would cut the wood and build a new house. Elisha was assured, he assured them that he would go with them. But when they got there, these sons of the prophets, being in poverty, all were cutting their wood, and yet they lost one of the axe heads. And when they did, it distressed them greatly. But here is an opportunity for God to show his mighty deeds. And so, as the apostles in 2 Corinthians 12:12 showed the signs of apostles, so this prophet showed the signs of a prophet. He cut a twig and threw it into the water. What had that to do with making the axe head float? I don't know. Probably about as much as when Jesus made the spittle and anointed the eyes of the blind man. But at any rate, this was the method by which it was done. The axe head floated. We realize that is extremely against all laws of nature, and therefore it declared unto them a confirmation of the words of Elisha, as well as the fact that God indeed was with them. Ben-Hadad was the king over Syria at this time, and for no apparent reason, in the next episode that happens, he begins to attack Israel. And when he does, of course, he lays private plans where he will ambush these soldiers, and yet every time he plans an ambush, they know his plans before he gets it executed. And in this, he thought there must be a spy among his own people. So he calls them all together and said, "All right, which one of you are for the king of Israel?" One of his men said to him, "O king, none of us are for him. But Elisha the prophet is over there with them, and he can tell the things you discuss in your bedchamber." Well, he said, "Where is Elisha? You go find out where he is. We'll take him captive, because a captive, he can't talk then." And so they went, and they found him over at Dothan. Dothan, as you recall, was the place where Joseph went looking for his brothers and where they sold him into bondage. You recall that there he went with his soldiers, with his chariots, with his horses, surrounded that little town of Dothan. And when the servant of Elisha got up early the next morning to do his chores, he was astonished at what was around that city. He ran back to Elisha, his master, and said, "Oh, master, what shall we do? There's horses and chariots all around in these hills." And Elisha prayed unto Jehovah and said, "Jehovah, open his eyes, that he may see the protection which thou hast given." You know, we as Christians sometimes think we're in this war alone. We think we're the only ones fighting. But God and one man make a majority. And so it was that when the eyes of the servant were opened, while there were chariots and horses of fire around about that city protecting Elisha. You recall that they came into the city and Elisha said, "Who are you looking for?" They said, "Elisha." He said, "I'll take you to him." Do you know what he did? He led them into the midst of Syria, or into Samaria rather, and there they were captives all of a sudden. He prayed that their eyes might be opened after they had been blinded, and they were there as captives. Well, what are they going to do about that? The king, first of all, considered that maybe he might just smite all of them. They were enemies. Why shouldn't he take their lives? Well, we remember that a miracle was what brought them there, and God's in control over these things. And so when the kingdom of Israel was minded to do that, he was restrained. And he was charged to supply them with food and water and to deliver them back to their king. Well, that's unusual treatment in war, to say the least. But you know, God's matters of doing things are different from ours. In Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, we're reminded that he said, "My ways are not your ways, and your thoughts aren't my thoughts. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." But you know what happened when he did deliver them back? There was peace in that land because of that. And that peace would not have been effected, and many would have been killed, perhaps, if Jehovah had not intervened. Well, we see these things taking place and God's fighting of enemies and how he subdues people, different from what maybe we might think. But war between these nations did cease for a while. It was about a year later when trouble began to erupt again, and Ben-Hadad surrounded Samaria, and he surrounded it and sealed it up so tightly that they were in a famine. And of course, because of the extent of hunger, the willingness on the part of the people to eat things they would not have thought about eating before, was brought to bear upon their lives. 80 shekels of silver were paid for an ass's head. Can you believe that? Would not have eaten it otherwise for anything. Children were boiled and eaten. And the horrible famine is pictured by a woman who sees a king. And she says, "Oh, king, have mercy upon us." And he says, "What is it here? Our helpless condition cannot be helped except Jehovah intervene in this." "But what's your real problem?" Well, she said, "My real problem is this. Another woman and I agreed that we would eat each other's children. And my dead son, we ate yesterday. And now she's hid hers and won't share him with me." Can you imagine any two mothers talking like this? She had hid her dead son and refused to share in cooking him for their meal. Moses had foretold about this in Deuteronomy 28. How that the very nicest of men would hate and not pay attention and have an evil eye concerning those around them, even their own relatives. And how a delicate woman who would not hardly touch the ground with her foot, but when it came to the famine, she would do things unimaginable. Well, these famines then became a great difficulty. The king evidently indicates to us that sin brought this famine, because his undergarments were sackcloth. And when he rent his garments over this woman, those were seen. And the discussing of this with her caused him to see even distress even greater. And so because of this, the torment of the king causes him to threaten the life of Elisha. He thinks Elisha should not have made the prophecy, or else he thinks he could have done something to stop it. You know, sometimes as God's messengers, we have difficulty with those who think we're to blame for the message. We must preach the word. And if it hits, my friends, in the middle of those who are wicked, let it hit. It'll have to do so, because we cannot restrain from speaking the word of God, and that alone, and that completely. Well, there was a man sent to Elisha whom he recognized before he got there as one of the murderers of Ahab. And so he has the door guarded for his safety. This infuriated messenger comes in and gives the king's message of despair to him, and that God must be to blame. Isn't it peculiar how many people want to blame God for their own sins? They never seem to think that they're to blame. It's God's fault when they have sinned. And so Elisha tells him a prophecy. He makes a prediction that the next day there's going to be plenty in Samaria. Well, this man scoffed at that. He couldn't believe that as hard as this famine had been, there would be plenty in the city of Samaria on the next day. Why, he said, "There'll be one measure of fine flour that'll sell for a shekel, and two measures of barley that'll sell for a shekel. Who can believe this?" they said. But he told that same man, he said, "You won't get to enjoy it." And he didn't tell him exactly why. But He pleased the man enough that the captain's unbelief caused him to take the prophecy back. And it was a prophecy, not only concerning the famine being broken, but also the death of that man who had brought the message. There were four leprous men. That was a very dreaded disease, but they'd been caught between the wall and the armies out there, and they saw for sure they were going to die. And rather than die, they said, "Why are we sitting out here like lame ducks fixing to be killed when we could go into the city and surrender and get all to eat that we need?" And they were very hungry. And so they went into the city to give themselves up. But how shocked they were when they got in there, they found the city was deserted. The Syrians had thought they heard the rumbling of horses and chariots, and they supposed, they presupposed, that the Syrians and their horses and chariots and a great host coming up on them were the kings who had hired the Hittites and the Egyptians to come and destroy them. And so when they got into the city, there wasn't anybody there except them. They began to eat to the full. They hid the raiment. They hid the gold, the silver. They wanted to despoil the tents, and they did that. They were keeping it for a later time. You know, it's hard to see these things and not understand some part of their situation. But then their conscience got to bother them. They said, "We don't do well. Here we are enjoying all of this good thing here, and our people are starving back over in the city of Samaria." So they returned. They told the good news to the porters, and the porters went to the king. Good news ought to be given out, shouldn't it? Good news, if we have it, ought to be spoken. And so the king said, "Well, I don't trust them. I think probably this is a ploy. You know, we go over there to get that food, and then they're going to take us alive as prisoners." But some of the people reasoned, "We're starving to death. If perchance it be true that the Syrians have left, we could have food." And so they said, "Get five horses." They only found two, I think, that had not already starved to death. And they sent these men over there to see what had happened. Well, they found clothing and articles of the Syrians all along the road because they had left in such a hurry. And there we find that these garments along the road and the equipment caused them to understand the haste with which they had departed. And they went in and found indeed that the Syrians were not there, and there was plenty of food. And the prophecy of Elisha was fulfilled that there would be food in Samaria's soul in the morrow, or on the morrow. Not only that, but the people were so hungry and so desirous of the food, they ran over that man who had carried the message to Elisha and killed him. And just as Elisha had said then, though he had had the prophecy, he would not get to enjoy the blessings of that food. Aren't these interesting accounts? Are you teaching them to your children? I hope you are. I hope you're reading these things. How interesting it is to find that Elisha also prophesies to a widow of a seven-year famine. At least it's a godly woman. I believe she was not a widow as yet, but she was the woman of Shunem. And this woman of Shunem had befriended Elisha. They'd even built a room for him. They provided a table, a stool, and a bed, and a lampstand. You know, it doesn't take much to show hospitality, does it? But Elisha loved to stop at their house, much like Jesus liked to go to Bethany, where Mary and Martha and Lazarus was. He had told her of this seven-year famine, so she went to the land of the Philistines for 7 years, and there she abode. When she got back, they had confiscated her property. And so, because the king had respect for Elisha, we find Gehazi, who had been given leprosy because he lied and tried to get money from Naaman, just back in 2 Kings 5, yet he is still the servant, evidently, of Elisha, and he's been disgraced and dismissed, but still the king thought he knew as much or more about Elisha than any other man. So when this leprous man, whom he took into his confidence, identifies this woman, then the king charges that all of her property should be returned, plus all of the fruits that had been gathered since she left. It's about this time that Elisha goes to Damascus. We don't know why. But we do know that King Ben-Hadad was very ill over there. And when he heard of Elisha's arrival, he sends one of his choice servants, Hazael, with 40 camels' burdens to go over there and see about his health from the prophet of God. He was to ask whether or not his health would return or whether or not he would die. And the answer given by Elisha was that his health would return, but he would die anyway. But the matter of it was to show that indeed God doesn't make mistakes. How could he get over his illness and still die? Well, Haziel is also told, you're going to do great harm to Israel. You are wicked, Haziel. And Haziel says, why, my dog? I'm not wicked. Have you ever seen a man admit his wickedness? I've never seen a man, especially a liberal person, who will admit he's wicked. Not too many people do. In fact, some of them even lie. Well, this man lied. Why, my dog? What do you think I am? You think I'd go back over there and kill the king? Well, he did. Went back over there and smothered him to death. He just told him half of the prophecy that was made. And then he smothered the king and took over his reign. He was king by murder. Haziel was one who returned over here and did the dirty deed to the king Ben-Hadad. Jehoram was king over Judah. Jehoram had an 8-year reign over Judah. We also find Joram, the son of Ahab, was over Israel in his 5th year of reign about this time. And his horrible deeds, Jehoram's, were influenced a lot by the wife he chose. Very important to choose the right kind of wife. Athaliah was the daughter of Ahab, and she'd married Jehoram. And just like her mother and father, she also held a great influence over him. His wickedness would have caused anyone to see the dangers to Judah, but it would have destroyed Judah except for the faithfulness of God toward the promises to David that he would always have a lamp or a successor in his family. We understand then that along about this time there is a secret anointing that takes place, and that is of Jehu. Elijah had heard 12 years before how this was to take place. After he had taken flight from Jezebel because she was going to kill him, God said, I'm not through with you, Elijah. I have some other things for you to do. And one of them was to anoint Jehu. Elijah was given the instruction for this, but he didn't carry it out except through his friend Elisha. Elisha sent one of the servants to secretly anoint Jehu, and then soon as he had done so, he said, you flee. Don't tarry there. And so you'll recall that his main task was to go and to anoint him king, which he did. And after Jehu is anointed king, he is hailed as the king of Israel. Though there's also another king of Israel right at this moment that has not been taken down out of the throne. Jehu would have the task of restoring pure worship of God unto Israel. And that is such a wonderful thing, and yet such a tragedy that it has to be done. But it seems throughout the centuries that has been the necessity of bringing people back to New Testament worship, or to the worship pure that God had given in the age in which they lived. Before leaving the place where Jehu was anointed, the young prophet predicted the end of the house of Ahab. And indeed, Jehu was to carry out that prophecy. God's law concerning committing murder, that is, that whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, Genesis 9:6, was certainly to be brought down heavily upon Ahab and his house. Blood dripped from their hands in their cold and cruel murders which they had done. Their whole family was wicked. They were corrupt in every way. And so because of that, we see God's especial punishment, not only on Ahab, but also on Jezebel and upon all of their house. The soldiers, of course, around Jehu when he was anointed began to question him. What did he say? What's going on here? And Jehu told them that he'd have been anointed king. Well, they before that time had chided him as a righteous man, and that shows us, of course, the world never approves righteous men. But Jehu was righteous, and they acknowledged then that appointment. They lay their garments down before his throne, which are simply the steps that he's standing on. And Jehu now is anointed the king. Joram, of course, has a conspiracy now against him, because Jehu is going to conspire against him, as he had kept Ramoth-Gilead, that he should take the rulership now. And it's God's will that that happen. Joram, as you'll recall, was recovering over in Ramoth-Gilead over in Jezreel from the wounds he had received at Ramoth-Gilead. And indeed, Jehu commanded that none be allowed to go tell him that he had already taken possession. The two kings that were over there, the king of Israel and king of Judah, Joram and Ahaziah, they didn't know about what had happened. when Jehu went over to that place. He gets to Jezreel, and they see him coming. They recognize someone out there. They send some men out to see if it's peace. He takes them captive. They send some more men out. He takes them captive. And finally, the king, Joram, and Ahaziah go out to meet Jehu themselves. They had already identified him by then because they said, look how he driveth furiously. He had a reputation that went before him. He was a man of war who drove in a furious way. I know a few preachers who do that. These kings were still uninformed, though, about what had happened to in Ramoth-Gilead, and so they approached Jehu in a peaceful manner. And as you know, they ask about peace. Is there peace? Is there peace? He said, how can there be peace as long as the whoredoms of thy mother Jezebel and her witchcrafts have led our people into idolatry? And they realized then he's not there for peace. You know, peace is not the first consideration when war is declared. And Jehu was declaring war on Ahab and all of his people. And so because of that, we see Jehu, when his real motive is seen, Joram begins to run. And he pulls his bow and his arrow out and shoots an arrow at Joram and hits him between the shoulder blade coming out at his heart. In 1 Kings 21, there's a prophecy that this event would happen, and now it's fulfilled. And thus, there are none that could say that Naboth's death, though it was a dastardly deed, had not been rewarded. Ahaziah begins to flee also. He hides himself, he thinks, but he is found and killed in his chariot, and he is buried in Jerusalem. In verses 30 through 37, there is the slaying of Jezebel. No mother in her right mind would name her daughter Jezebel, because she ruined that name for all future time. Jezebel was among the most wicked of women that ever lived. Evidently, she was very attractive. But Jehu wants to ensure her death. And so he takes himself into Jezebel, where she is abiding. And when she knows he is coming in her facade and trying to escape her death, she paints herself up real good. She paints her eyes, she puts a turban on her head, she perches herself, the Bible says, in a window, and she tries to attract Jehu's affections. It didn't work. Jehu sees her and says, who is with me? And some eunuchs said, we are. He said, okay, throw her down. And they threw her down. She burst asunder and was trampled by the horses. The prophecy had been that there would be nothing left to bury. And indeed, there was not. All they could find of her was her skull, the palms of her hands, and the bottom of her feet. Not enough to even bury. And no place shall ever be known as her burying place. Her wicked life indeed ended in a horrible way. Jehu was made king over Israel. He wrote letters to Ahab's cohorts about the 70 sons of Ahab. He had married lots of women. And he had lots of children, numbers of wives and children, most of them raised by nobles and servants. But at any rate, Jehu set out to destroy the entire royal line. He wrote a letter in very much irony, and he challenges their strength. He said, just choose you a king and come against me. And of course, they were fearful of that, and they wouldn't do it. They wrote back and said, we won't choose any king, and we'll do anything you say. You know, promises are easy to make. He wrote them a second letter, and he said, all right, I want the heads of the 70 sons of Ahab in a basket. And they did it. They put those heads of the 70 sons by night in two heaps outside the gates of the city. And there they proved that all resistance against Jehu had been subdued, and the allegiance that had formerly been given to Ahab had been fully removed. And so we find Jehu is now in the rulership. That should have been sufficient, but never could there have been a so ironical a statement than to say that these men who murdered these men were righteous men. Indeed, they were not. Jehu was also wicked. But he tried to exonerate himself by saying, this is the will of God. You know, so many people who have done evil in the past have said, this is the will of God. But indeed, if God has not spoken it, it's not the will of God. And we must abide in those things which Jehovah has spoken. We must do no more and no less. it is not right for us to go beyond or fail to come up to the things which God has commanded. So Jehu carried out his evil intent. He carried out Jehovah's prophecy, but then he took more than that. 42 men were slain at the place where the shepherds was. And we know that every related male of Jezebel, Joram, Ahaziah, and Ahab's friends, and also his priest, were all killed. And then the kinsmen of Ahaziah, who was the past king of Judah, were killed also. There was one man who had great influence, and Jehu wanted to ride with him down the street so he could show himself off. He asked him if he approved of getting rid of idolatry, and the man said, "Well, of course I do." And of course, Jehu hadn't gotten rid of all the idolatry himself, because those idols of calves that had been set up down at Dan and Bethel, he still worshiped those. And it was a shameful thing, but at any rate, he did. He made a great pretense that he wanted to serve Baal. He said, "Where you've served him little, I want to serve him a lot. You bring all the Baal worshipers in here from everywhere. In fact, if they don't come, they're under the sentence of death." Well, they had a big crowd. I imagine we would if we had that sentence out tonight. Some people who are not here would be here if they thought their lives were threatened. But he got all of the worshipers of Baal together, and subtly he made pretense he wanted to worship Baal too. But he had 80 men stationed outside, and he said, "Don't you let one of these people leave here alive. I'm going to wipe out Ahab. I'm going to wipe out idolatry." And 80 men were stationed ready for the brutal slaying. All of Baal's people were killed. Plus the house was burned down and made a draught house. And Baal was strictly wiped out of Israel. But Jehu didn't end his idolatry. I suggested a moment ago that he went to Dan and he went to Bethel. And he, of course, though having the commendation of Jehovah, also had the censure of Jehovah. And in that commendation and censure, we find that partial obedience was what Jehovah was charging him with. To partially obey the Lord is like not obeying him at all. If we only do what pleases us, as Saul did when he went to kill the Amalekites, then it's not worth anything. Jehu indeed destroyed the Baal worship, but he continued to worship at these idolatrous gods himself. Jeroboam's sins in making the images were wrong. The places of worship were wrong. The days that he chose to serve were wrong. And the place was wrong. And yet he thought he was doing the will of God, he said. He did this under the challenge to the people, "It's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem." And we still have some tonight who say, "It's too hard to do just exactly what the pattern says. Why can't we do this just as well? If it suits us, why wouldn't it suit God?" But friend, personal and family interest placed above the authority of God will bring us nothing but shame and heartache and destruction. Well, idolatry began to take its toll on Israel, and the land was removed. And Hazael, king of Syria, was allowed by Jehovah to conquer much of the land east of the Jordan. Elisha had predicted, you know, these difficulties for Israel because of their sin. And in the 28th year of the reign of Jehu, his life ended, and he was buried in Samaria, and then his son took his reign. All of these things are written for our understanding, for our learning. God's hand is seen in them all. Pride can bring us to destruction, but the providence of God works strongly in our lives. We may wonder how God's going to work. Of course, God's providence always works through natural law. It never works in a miraculous way. The answers to prayer also work through God's natural law, never according to miracles in our day. But there may be temptation to think, well, maybe God has forgotten us. Maybe God is no longer with us. But when we remember all of his goodness and the mighty works that he exemplified throughout the Old Testament, how wonderful it is to find our reaffirmation of faith. Who gave us life? Who gave us the purpose for which we're here? Who prepares for us a city which hath foundations, whose builder and maker is God? Who keeps all of the world orderly and in operation? Surely such power has not been of one who has forgotten his children. Therefore, with assurance we say, no God is as great as our God. And his eyes are upon the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayers. But the face of the Lord is against them that do evil. 2 Peter 3:12. Thank you for your rapt attention tonight.